Good day, and welcome to ARO Global Q1 2023 results conference call. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be in listen only. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions, and this can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero and you'll be connected to an operator. Presenting today's call, we have Zach Louis, CEO and CIO, and Phil Shepherd, Chief Commercial Officer. I will now hand over to Zach Louis, CEO and CIO. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. It's a pleasure to be with you to chat through our Q1 results. As you see on page three of the presentation, we wanted to show you the progress we've made across a number of variables that really evidence our progression towards the capital-light, vertically integrated fund manager model. I think you'll agree, compared to where the business was last year, we've made very noticeable progress towards that set of goals. We'll talk through the specific numbers as we go throughout the presentation, so I wasn't gonna comment off page three on each individual variable, but I think seeing them together hopefully gives you a composite picture of our progression towards a more capital-light model with more fee income generation, leading to a gradual deleveraging. If we turn to page four, we collected considerably better than ERC, and we're really pleased with that. We obviously highlight that relative to prior quarter, relative to prior year, it is lower. I think it's important to remember that as the business has moved towards having more secured real estate and secured loans as the primary investment activity, you get the benefit of that real estate collateral as security, but inherit the, obviously, the lumpiness that comes with selling buildings versus collecting a typical 20 pound payment, you know, on a credit card, which obviously in volume has a less security but a smoother profile. If you see from the outperformance against ERC, we have done well in collecting out the back book. Phil will talk about that in more detail, but obviously you'll see that the lumpiness of individual real estate settlements, real estate sales, secured loan settlements will have that inherent lumpiness as we run through. That's led to a look through in terms of both EBITDA and leverage, but doesn't change the overall direction, which is as we continue to have higher AUM, collect out more and invest at the 10% level, we will delever strongly, and Phil will talk you through that profile. If we move to the progress on the strategic side of that journey and this quarter's specific achievements, we closed ACO2 at the hard cap in Q1 at $2.75 billion. It is, according to Private Debt Investor, the largest distressed fund in the world that closed in Q1 and the fourth largest debt fund of any type that closed in Q1. As a regional player, you know, on our second generation of fund, we're very pleased with that progression. We'll talk through in coming pages why we think we've had that success. I guess the other major achievement of the quarter in this area of the business is that with only a month of fundraising, we've already had a first closing on our real estate product. Now, long-term observers of ARO will remember we bought Norfin 5 years ago. We bought Eagle Street this quarter. We bought Sansidoni, which is a small business in Italy that was Monte Paschi Siena's real estate manager a couple years ago. We've been working towards having a very compelling real estate strategy. The incremental capabilities we have on those platforms alongside our core footprint, which now services 79 billion euros of servicing assets, has given us the scale, credibility, and track record to achieve now a discretionary real estate product. That product has already made its first two investments, and fundraising momentum in that product remains very strong. We've set that up more as an evergreen vehicle And so we will continue to see, I think, quite attractive fundraising into that vehicle. Obviously, people have strong support for the idea that the real estate market has some vulnerabilities, and having the size of footprint we have to be closest to the assets to find really good things to buy in any coming dislocation has motivated investors to back up and do it as quickly as this, which is really encouraging. We continue to scale the origination of our core ACO product, hitting $209 million in the first quarter. That's very strong relative to prior periods. Normally, the second and the fourth quarter have the highest seasonality, and so that's really good progress in terms of Q1. And returns remain strong despite any macro headwinds. The Q1 return for ACL1, having now collected 840 million euros in ACL1, and so with a considerable percentage of the fund move forward in terms of realized and some of that distributed and some of that recycled, we now have an 18% IRR at the deal level. And ACO2 has started even more strongly, both on IRRs being at 20 and money multiples being 0.3 higher than at the same point of ACO1. It is a good market to buy in, and having about $2.5 billion of dry powder is where you want to be in this format. I guess also from a strategic perspective, we're super excited that Maslow has had a record quarter. As banks have struggled in this environment, Maslow has been in a great position to pick up real estate lending opportunities, and they did £400 million of real estate lending in just Q1, which was a record for Maslow. We own 49% of Maslow and have an option to buy the rest. And pleasingly, 100% of that was sourced from external LPs. None of that was Arrow Co-Invest. And I guess equally exciting, almost all of that LP volume was from legacy investors of Arrow, our LPs who've now backed the Maslow platform to scale that business. And so the strategy of creating that as a third product on top of ACO, on top of AREO, the real estate product we announced today, is going, frankly, ahead of our expectations. In terms of delivering the core performance, we are on track to complete the sale of the non-core UK platforms, the CAF Plus and Mars UK platforms, which we've announced previously. Phil will talk through how that affects the numbers, but we think that's a good strategic achievement to get out of a crowded space and a space with lower security and less interest to our LPs, less than 0.5% of origination is now in those areas, and hence it doesn't really affect our origination at all. And so recycling that capital to delever is an obvious strategic next step. And so we're very close to completing that, so we'll talk to that. And for a minor acquisition, we did complete Eagle Street's purchase for £8 million. That has been very helpful. I mean, Eagle Street has about $1.75 billion of AUM from LP investors, and so is already a credible and leading real estate platform in parts of the market where our investors have been very supportive and encouraged. It gives us a Northern European anchor to go alongside Northfin and Sansidonia, which have always been strong in Southern Europe. And so we continue to build a footprint we want to support successful raising capital, deploying capital, and collecting capital. And I think we've done that in a cost-effective manner. The EBITDA in the fund management sector was up slightly. I guess I would just point out that that is against a different comparator, i.e. the prior year number includes the UK platforms, and we've now been able to grow EBITDA whilst now excluding the platforms that we're selling to Interim as per above. So the comp has a smaller perimeter versus the denominator, and it's still up. So across that, I feel like we've made very strong strategic progress in terms of delivering the footprint we need to continue to grow AUM and continue to build the fee income as that flows through into our numbers over coming quarters. return to page 5. The reason that's done well is, and I think on this we're high conviction, and it's proving that investors, despite macro headwinds against the fundraising environment, continue to back us strongly, is we really have the fundamentally right business model for Europe. The truth is Europe is a very fragmented territory. It's got 44 countries, 24 languages, 6,000 banks, et cetera. It's super fragmented and local. And the idea that you're going to have a typical fund manager model of having a London office that goes and hunts for deals in all of these small nooks and crannies of the 44 countries and all the localities, it might work in corporate credit. It doesn't work at all in asset-based credit or equity. So if you're looking for real estate deals where the typical underlying asset is a, you know, 7 million pound multifamily residence, you're not going to do that effectively from London. It's just not possible. And most LPs have a considerable allocation to corporate credit. They do CLOs, they do bonds, they do direct lending, they do leveraged loans. There's a whole series of ways they access sponsor credit and corporate credit. There's a structural underweight in most investors as it relates to real estate and asset-based credit because most GPs can't deliver it to them. And so the reason, I mean, amongst others, that we've had very strong fundraising success is that we fundamentally have a model that gets local and makes asset-based credit available to investors. And I think buying those assets or investing those assets at an appropriate LTV is a fundamental equation that investors understand. And now we have a capital structure across Maslow to do it as lender, ACO to do it as credit buyer, and AREO to do it as buying the real estate in hard asset form. And so investors have gotten strongly behind that. We service 79 billion euros in assets. We've got 19 platforms, 2,300 employees. We've got an amazing local footprint that's very strong to find those opportunities and deliver that to investors. And I think people have a fundamental understanding that in Europe there is a scarcity value to the real estate. There's a housing shortage in most countries. And so accessing an asset class where 80% of our investments have residential real estate as the collateral at this stage is a fundamentally attractive asset class. And the strength of our fundraising is a testimony to them understanding that strategic achievement. If I move to page 6, we really just show it split into those three areas, which is how our investors see it. Now, we use exactly the same origination footprint, underwriting footprint, and servicing footprint to support all of our products. I mean, our 19 platforms and the Arrow servicing business is the core platform footprint that supports all of our activities. However, obviously, within the investor community, these are three separate desks. So there's a real estate arm of most LPs, there's a direct lending arm of most LPs, and there's a special fixed, distressed, active investment strategies, opportunistic credit arm of most LPs. And so one of the things that's a key strategic achievement over the last couple of years is we've ported the interface point of our LPs from just being the original ACO credit relationship into now successfully raising capital across all three of these product areas, which often, in some LPs, it's the same people. In many LPs, particularly the large ones, it's separate teams. And so the fact that we've gotten positive support from separate teams is really important for scalability. I mean, as you saw when we showed you the progress of ACO2 earlier in the year, the progress we've made in accessing large sovereigns, pension funds, and insurance companies as the three largest categories has been, you know, really fantastic. And the fact that we've now got them in different teams gives us a lot of confidence in where we can go with our fundraising momentum. And then as we show you here, we've made good progress deploying capital in all three areas. And, you know, we're really pleased with how all of that is progressing. Turning to page 7, we focus on ACO, obviously the most mature of our products, in more detail. So we deployed $209 million, as you see, very strong progression year on year. We remain very selective, so achieving the 20% after servicing cost IRR is a pleasing place to be. We've deployed or committed just over 400 million euros of ACO2. the strong majority of deployment from here is in ACO 2. And so where in Q4 we still had some ACO 1 and Q1 a little bit of ACO 1, those have kept Arrow's relative share higher than the 10%. We're hopeful based on pipeline and activity that since ACO 1 only does follow-ons now, those have started to tail off, and almost all of the origination going forward is in ACO 2, which is where all new name investing goes, and that will get Arrow's capital intensity down, you know, particularly on a go-forward basis. As you see, we continue to deploy it well, delivering both a diversification of underlying activities between credit and bankruptcy, and an underlying activity between the different geographies where we're strong. That is a portfolio composition that our investors have supported, and we provide you the detail on the private debt investor lead table where we came out, you know, positively, as you see. With that, I'll hand over to Phil to talk through the numbers.
Thanks, Zach, and good morning, everyone. I'll start by talking through the cash performance of the group, which is shown on slide 9. I'm pleased that strong collections have continued and represented 117% of ERC for the quarter, and demonstrates the ability of our local platforms to continue to drive and accelerate collections. As we've stated previously, our ERC profile is increasingly lumpy in nature as investments in real estate and collateral-backed portfolios increase. And in particular, there was a single large collection in Q1 last year of $15.3 million. And so despite the strong performance against ERC, collections were $26.6 million lower than last year, reflecting this ERC profile. Despite the falling collections, adjusted EBITDA only fell by $15.9 million to $72.1 million for the quarter, as the growth in capital-light revenues and our focus on cost control partially mitigated the collections reduction. The impact of the ERC profile has led to a short-term increase in liquidity in leverage to 4.4 times at the end of the quarter. When we come to the balance sheet segment slide, I will talk about the strong progress that is forecast to be made through the remainder of 2023 towards the medium-term strategic commitment of 3 times. Free cash flow generation was $53 million for the quarter, with free cash flow after investment in new portfolios of $29 million, benefiting from the reduced co-investment level for ACO 2 at 10% rather than 25% for ACO 1. And the build of management fees and in due course carried interest as we scale our capital-light revenue streams will further improve the cash generation of the business and enable further deleveraging. Moving on to the segmental results and starting with the integrated fund management segment shown on slide 10. And just to recap, the integrated fund management segment represents the capital-light revenues of the group from our integrated asset management and servicing and fund management activities. Reported revenues have decreased by 9% year on year to $45 million. However, revenues of $9.5 million generated in the quarter by our UK platforms Mars and CapQuest are no longer included in the underlying results. On a like-for-like basis, revenues have grown $5.1 million as we expand our integrated fund management franchise with increased management fees as fund NAV grows and continued strong appetite for our services from customers with asset management and servicing contract wins. Despite the removal of the performance of our UK platforms from the underlying results, EBITDA has increased by 3% to $8.4 million for the quarter. Our capital-light earnings over the last 12-month period have risen to $40 million, a 69% increase on the 12-month period to March 2022. The ongoing operational leverage has widened the EBITDA margin, increasing from 16.8% in quarter 1 2022 to 18.9% for this quarter. And going forward, I expect both the EBITDA and EBITDA margin to grow as we scale FUM, growing management fees, and in time recognising carried interest, with revenue growth continuing the trend of outpacing cost growth. Now turning to the balance sheet segment on slide 11. As I noted earlier, the cash performance has been strong with collections 117% of ERC for the quarter, despite the challenging macroeconomic environment. We've continued to demonstrate our ability to drive and accelerate collections performance through our local platforms. Despite the strong cash performance against ERC, balance sheet segment EBITDA decreased by 7.8 million to 12.8 million, primarily due to the accounting treatment of the assets subject to the divestment to Intrum. No cost or income on the full 100% of the wholly owned UK assets subject to the divestment are included within the underlying results. Under the lockbox mechanism, any under or over performance on the 50% portion to be retained by Arrow will change the re-recognition value on completion. During Q1 2022, the EBITDA on these portfolios was circa 5 million. And further details on the accounting treatment of the divestment are shown on slide 21. The chart on the bottom right of this slide shows the expected cash realisations from our investment portfolios for 2023 against the actual cash realisations collections in 2022. And I expect cash realisations and collections of circa 420 million for the year. This represents the actual collections in quarter one, the ERC on our investment portfolios updated for a new profile on the 50% of the wholly owned UK portfolios retained by Arrow, together with 91 million expected cash realisation on the other 50% divested to Intrum. It does not include any collections on portfolios acquired through the remainder of the year, and also does not include the proceeds from the sale of the CapQuest and Mars platforms. Such cash realisations collections will be 40 million higher than 2022, and through the remainder of 2023 will represent strong progress towards the medium-term strategic leverage commitment of 3x. Slide 12 shows the group segment, which primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. The segmental loss has remained broadly flat at 7.2 million despite inflationary pressures. As our funds under management grow, there is an increased allocation of our group overheads to the fund, which together with the strong cost control has paid for the reinvestment, enabling us to scale our operations and accelerate the transition to our integrated fund manager model. This investment leaves us well placed to take advantage of the opportunities to grow our capital light fee model in adjacent asset classes, including real estate, where we have announced the launch of our real estate fund AREO today, and also direct lending, where we are investing in a bridge lending proposition and continuing to support Maslow, which we own 49% of. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 13, which shows the EBITDA segmental results that I've explained. But just to recap, that the loss before tax and adjusting items of 10.4 million does not include any income on 100% of the wholly owned UK portfolios subject to the divestment, which generated EBITDA of 5 million in Q1 2022, or any profits from the CapQuest or Mars platforms whose results are reported in adjusting items. The result has been negatively impacted by rising interest rates from financing costs, with financing costs some 6.1 million higher than Q1 2022, reflecting rising interest rates and the costs of maintaining the high levels of liquidity headroom. As I've stated previously, the group now generates surplus income in euros. This is predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds. And as such, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility, which was a 1.6 million gain in the quarter. Despite the uncertain economic backdrop, I'm delighted that we've continued to deliver a strong collections performance, and this is shown in detail on slide 14, and emphasises the strong focus we have on cash. Collections of 81.5 million in the quarter represented 117% of ERC. Our collections performance across all types of portfolios and all geographies continues to be encouraging, and despite the cost of living impacts, inflationary pressures and broader economic uncertainty, I believe our ERC reflects assumptions in line with the uncertain outlook and broader economic expectations, and we continue to adopt a cautious approach to our ERC and underwriting of new portfolio investments. As we've noted previously, the ERC profile is increasingly lumpy as the level of investments into real estate or collateral-backed portfolios increases. We continue to believe that such portfolios deliver the best risk-adjusted returns, and our local platforms have continued to demonstrate their ability to drive and accelerate collections above our ERC. Slide 15 shows the free cash flow generation of 53 million during the quarter. Free cash flow exceeded the cash investments on portfolios by 29 million compared with 27 million for the same period last year, with the vast majority of investments at the 10% co-investment level now, including the new real estate fund. The development of the integrated fund manager model with the increasing levels of capital-light revenue will continue to drive the deleveraging of the business. The net debt position is shown on slide 16. The net cash inflow after investments of 29 million has predominantly funded the actual cash payment of portfolio investments recorded in prior periods. As such, the overall increase in the sterling equivalent of net debt of 22 million has funded the acquisition of Eagle Street and the payment of year-end bonuses accrued in 2022 and paid this quarter. Net debt will reduce upon completion of the divestments, but I also expect the underlying trading to drive lower net debt, particularly as investments into ACO2 and AREO have a 10% co-investment level. Slide 17 shows our leverage and funding position. The ERC profile has led to a short-term increase in leverage to 4.4 times from 4.1 times at December 2022. And deleveraging remains a core focus, and we remain committed to reducing leverage to circa 3 times and repaying debt over the medium term. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term on our debt is 4 years, and we have 223 million of liquidity headroom. As noted previously, an increasing level of our ERC comprises co-investments made through the fund. Such an ERC is measured net of servicing costs. And over a third of our ERC is now measured at fair value through the P&L and hence net of servicing costs. And despite this, our 120-month ERC rose by 2% over the quarter and is 7% higher than March 2022. Given the current economic challenges and the impacts that this has had on the high-yield bond funding markets, I believe the strength of our liquidity and funding position and our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to take advantage of the opportunities in our markets. We've made excellent progress accelerating the transition to the leading integrated fund manager, growing the number of discretionary funds from 1 to 3 over the last 12 months. As we scale our operations, we are able to grow our capital-light revenue streams without placing strain on our balance sheet. Through the strong cash performance with the divestment of our UK platforms and 50% of the wholly owned UK portfolios, together with the growth in revenue within our integrated fund management segment, I forecast strong progress towards the medium-term strategic leverage commitments of 3x through the remainder of 2023. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thanks, Phil. So just in final summary on page 19, as you see, we've made really impressive, I think, strategic progress towards delivering the fund manager model in a way that's scalable and highly accretive. I think as we look at the overall progression from the legacy business model of having a balance sheet buying portfolios into the fund manager model, which uses that whole track record and servicing footprint to drive a much higher, as we talked about in prior periods, 40% return on capital by the time you count in the fee income, which comes to us on top of our returns from just putting up 10% of our capital in each deal and having the capacity to charge servicing fees, management fees, et cetera, on the other 90%, which comes from our co-investors in the funds. It's a super attractive place to be. I think you'll appreciate all of us are impatient to see that flow through the numbers as we progress that growth in the fund management model. And as we, because we charge fees on NAV, on actually deployed capital and not on committed capital, there's just a time lag for that to flow through. And Phil and I share an impatience and a drive to get there, which will then lead to the deleveraging. Obviously, the sale of CapQuest and Mars and half of the portfolios that they were servicing, it drives good progression in that regard. And so I think you will see that progression and all the fundamental numbers that come off it improve strongly in the coming quarters. On the back of that, we're happy with this strategy and be very happy with the delivery of the strategy and looking forward to, I think, seeing that flow through the numbers in a very attractive way in the coming quarters. With that, we will pass to questions, operator.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question from the queue, it's *2. Again, please press *1 to ask a question over the phone. We'll take the first question from Carl Stretcher from Guggenheim. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. In terms of just the general real estate pricing environment, you mentioned 80% secured on residential real estate collateral, I think was what you said on the call. How do you view kind of real estate pricing moves as you see them at the moment? Have there not been material moves? It doesn't seem like it's impacted on your collections in previous quarters. Clearly it creates an attractive fundraising environment, but how do you see any negative real estate pricing trends impacting potentially on collections performance as you collect on more historic investments in the back book?
Thanks, Carl. So so there's a lot in that question. If I separate out the elements of the answer, you've got, let's separate market, fundraising, investment opportunities, and back book, because I think how the market affects each of those is quite nuanced. So on the market environment, what we basically see is that bid-ask spreads are quite wide, right? Because if you're a seller right now, you're taking the optimistic view that interest rates have peaked, running inflation is half of where it was, interest rates are likely to come on a downward trajectory to go forward, and so I'm not a price taker now at these financing costs and these discount rates on a kind of permanent roll forward basis. If you're a buyer, you obviously take the opposite side of that narrative and say, look what's on the screen. I got to charge you for where discount rates are, where financing costs are now. Accordingly, as a buyer, of course, we take the cynical view of how higher financing costs would affect asset prices. And so what we're seeing is it's not that sellers are coming out with billion-dollar deals that are easy to transact. By contrast, the opportunities are small and localized where, in many cases, sellers are forced to sell. They can't refinance. It's too expensive to refinance. You know, funds at end of life. The bank market for what they do is slowed down, and so selling becomes the most attractive alternative versus their other options. And that is frequent on small perimeter or single asset deals, which are the ones that our franchise is best at because they tend to happen at a very local level. So that's how it affects the buy side. On fundraising, I think people accept that that is a very likely rich vein of opportunity. And if you're servicing 79 billion euros, you're probably closest to the assets and in a very incumbent position to spot those opportunities. You know, we've got more than 200 banks as clients, obviously 35 million total borrowers. We've lots of lines of sight into interesting local situations at that size point where we can invest on very attractive terms. On the back book, you'll obviously recall that the vast majority of the back book was bought in credit form. I mean, the real estate equity element, it was not a significant part of our historical balance sheet investment basis. And so we had an LTV buffer on the back book. And since house prices haven't fallen in any substantive way yet, that LTV buffer has been sufficient to allow us to collect out the back book at better than ERC. And then on the roll forward opportunity, I think we expect the dynamics I've just described to continue for quite some time. I mean, obviously, none of us have a crystal ball on the macro. If interest rates go down and the economy stays strong, then you know, there's probably upside to our back book. And if conversely, which I personally think is more likely, but I mean, none of us are macroeconomic forecasters, that, you know, the rising financing costs have to have downward pressure on asset prices like gravity, then, you know, having the huge amount of dry powder that we've raised and having a product in the market that on the real estate side had no back book makes it a very attractive product for investors to allocate to, right? I mean, from a real estate equity investor's perspective, which is the target audience of AREO, we have all the benefits of that origination and asset management machine without a legacy back book to worry about. And obviously there's an asymmetry of that because Arrow's back book is bought almost entirely in credit form, where it hence had an LTV buffer and was bought at a discount, where AREO is targeting that future opportunity in an equity form, which, you know, I think the market, particularly in a declining asset price world, will present a very fertile buying opportunity. So those are all the nuances as to how we think it
Understood.
Will affect the opportunities.
In terms of the back book, then, should we think about, like, what percentage of the time do you ultimately realize based on the underlying real estate valuation? And clearly, if there's a decline in prices, that's going to impact that outcome. But it sounded like, generally speaking, you are underwriting to real estate valuations, but ultimately you're collecting you know, more on the value of the credit outstanding rather than having to go through to the real estate value. Can you kind of give a percentage of the time that you do need to go and foreclose and realize on real estate rather than collecting in kind of a credit obligation?
Yeah, for sure. So we only have to go to the full kind of last step foreclosure about 5% of the time. I mean, that percentage does evolve a bit with market conditions, but up till now, that number is 5%.
Understood. And maybe moving then into, I guess, the real estate away from the opportunities. In terms of Maslow, what is the timing that of the option that you have to purchase the other 51% of Maslow? And, you know, how should we think about potential magnitude of capital should you look to exercise that option?
Phil, I'll take the first half of that question if you want to take the second half. So in terms of the terms of the deal and the strategic, we had a 5-year window from when we bought it. So we have the thick end of 4 years left to exercise. I think in terms of the strategic side of that, I think what we wanted to see was that Maslow fit in the family, right? That the real estate credit product they offered is attractive to our investors, and B, that we could fundraise effectively and support high quality deployment at good risk adjusted returns, et cetera. And I think we've proven that out quite well. I mean, it's often on roadshows we hear investors attracted to the reality that right now they can earn, you know, considerably higher returns on real estate credit than they were getting for real estate equity on core and core plus assets just 2 years ago. That has not gone unnoticed at any of the main investor bases we work with. And that's obviously driven Maslow to a record quarter. We obviously fixed the price of the option when we bought them 2 years ago. So that business progression is to our benefit. And so, I think if we can continue to drive volumes like $400 million in a quarter in lending, all with third-party capital, and create a third leg of the product set, you know, we have ACO 1, we have ACO 2, we have AREO. If we can create an Arrow lending opportunities in the future, that's obviously very attractive to us. And so I think you could reasonably expect that's the direction we're seeking to go. But so I don't know if you want to comment on timing or magnitude or whether we'll disclose that, you know, when we come to that point.
Yeah, I mean, there is a reasonable amount of disclosure in the annual report accounts, the year-end annual report and accounts. So you'll see that broadly speaking, the magnitude of the option payments is around about 60-ish million, I think as Zach said, you know, the timing of that will be largely dependent upon the, you know, when we prove that they're a good fit with the RA family and that, you know, the fundraising side of things can it makes sense to bring them into Arrow so that we can accelerate that fundraising for them.
Understood. And do you currently, you own 49%, so that's not consolidated into your fee income reporting as it stands, is that correct?
That's correct. It's shown as a an interest below the line. Yeah.
Understood. And then lastly for me, I guess just a couple of things on disclosure. It'd be very helpful if you could split out the income within the servicing, the fee component between servicing and fund manager. You know, as it stands at the moment, it's just very difficult to model because we have a kind of a combined number, and there's very different underlying drivers in terms of those components. So I know originally when you did the deal, they were separated out, and you kind of combined into one segment, and there might be some issues around the cost side, but I would presume that, you know, separating out on the income between those two categories should be doable. So that would be a request that we would make, just to allow us to model and have greater greater visibility as we move forward and you continue on the transition. And then the last thing, sorry, was just in terms of your management fee income, that's based on NAV, obviously. Is the NAV typically deployments at cost, or is there any kind of fair valuation adjustment that impacts the NAV? Like, presumably, you know, you're not investing capital and then carrying it at ERC, or maybe you are, but can you just clarify that in terms of the basis for the fund management income to be calculated on?
Why don't I take the fund management point, and then you can pick up anything after that. So I think so at the point at which we buy any asset as an investment in ACO1 or ACO2, ARIO works the same way. It tends to go on balance sheet at the investment basis value and then gets revalued every quarter, which is a mixture of effectively forecasting out future cash flows and then MPVing them back on a composite of the specific discount rate for that asset plus any movements in the risk-free rate of that asset. So if it was a five-year average life Portuguese asset, you MPV it at
Understood. That's
and then we charge the management fee against that resulting number, which has an upward trajectory if performance goes well, and a downward trajectory if performance goes badly. But is broadly, from a modeling perspective, is orders of magnitude in the beginning of an asset life similar to the acquisition value, and then if performance improves, they tend to get written up, and if obviously performance deteriorates, they get written down. But Phil,
yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, Carl, I know you've raised the points around the disclosures, before, and I think, you know, from our perspective, let me again say that way, but we do see that the integrated nature of our operations, where our platforms are feeding the fund management business and operations, we do see them increasingly integrated, and hence, you know, that was why we changed the segmental reporting last year. We've improved the segmentals. We give those on a quarterly basis, whereas they were only done half yearly previously. So, but let me take away the actual revenue disclosure. Yeah, thanks.
Right. Thanks for all the color. Cheers.
We will now take the next question from Neil Simpson from ICG. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. Just two questions on the fund management side. So the first one, for the real estate equity fund, you mentioned this is an evergreen fund. Just curious how that works. And I guess the broader question is, what I think there's a comment that additional fundraising expected in 2023. Not sure if you can comment on what the opportunity set is.
Yeah, definitely, Neil. So we how do I describe this? So you have if you may know, depending on what level of detail we want to get into, I'll start, and if you want to refine, obviously follow up. But there are different models people use for that real estate asset class. You've got at one extreme a typical 3+5+2 private equity lockup style model. At the opposite extreme, you have something like BREIT, you know, the and I don't want to talk about competitors' products, but effectively with the kind of semi-liquid model that came under a lot of criticism last year, where basically investors come into the fund at NAV and then are fully exposed to whether NAV is marked correctly and any worries they have about legacy back books. But you get the advantage of having, you know, up to 5% liquidity redemption capacity. We fundamentally don't believe that you should offer a liquid or semi-liquid capital structure against real estate equity, which is a fundamentally illiquid asset. And we just think that's not fundamentally sound. Equally, I think if you're selling or investing an opportunistic real estate activity, I think investors want to have confidence that if they give you the money now, you're actually deploying into real estate opportunities in the current environment. And I think there's a wide investor base who, on that product, with that thematic, you know, if they hand you the capital and it's 3 years to deploy it, 5 years to harvest it with two extensions, for an asset that may only have a 30-month weighted average life, they're making a 10-year commitment. And so I felt from a marketing perspective, and frankly just a fundamental CIO outlook, you didn't have to do that. You didn't need a structure that tied people's money up for 10 years for an average asset hold, you know, closer to 2.5 or 3 years. And so we've come up with a structure where effectively the money is locked up, so there's no access to liquidity faster than we sell the asset. But in effect, it is split into annual series for investment purposes and then distributed back to investors when the assets are sold. I mean, these are real estate equity pieces, so this is basically selling buildings. Investors have the option of effectively, instead of getting the proceeds back building by building as they get sold, they have the option of ticking the box to just have all proceeds reinvested. And so far, the investors we have in that vehicle have all ticked the box. Assuming that trend continues, it will have an evergreen nature to it, and we'll have locked up capital for as long as we hold the hard assets, which obviously is on discretion and has that attractive feature, but gives investors the chance to invest with us, deploy with us, live the asset life with us, and then decide to roll over as we scale. And that we think it's had a very, I mean, as you see from, you know, we've only been marketing for a month and we've already closed what we've closed. It's had a very positive response, I think, is a clever way of doing it right, basically putting in a product that has an asset liability matching to the asset life, is thereby giving investors the capital back and creating that legitimate liquidity with the asset life without tying them up for 10 years or giving them a false, you know, 5% liquidity that as soon as people want to get out gets gated anyway. Maybe if you want to a lot more questions, we can go offline on the exact details, but that hopefully gives you some shape of what we're doing there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And just what do you think is the size, you know, total fundraising for this year, if you've only been marketing for a month and have 100 locked in?
Yeah, so we're optimistic. We've had very strong investor demand. Even how early it is, we haven't given a target, which I guess you're picking up. Let us comment on that in coming quarters. We're optimistic we'll make a lot of progress, and we expect this to be a material product. We wouldn't have set it out as a separate product if it was going to be irrelevant. We would have kept it in our larger flagship product. The fact that we've successfully put it out and gotten early traction, plus what we see in the fundraising pipeline, we're optimistic to let us harden a specific number target in coming quarters. We will give you guidance
okay.
in due course once we have more experience with it.
Fair enough. And I guess similar line of question on the Maslow product, because it sounded like from a previous answer that you're a bit hesitant to say that you'd raise a fund behind Maslow. Are you waiting till you fully consolidate that? Or because obviously $400 million of deployment in one quarter is very impressive.
Yeah. We're very impressed with the team, and we're impressed with the business. To give you some sense, I mean, Maslow has done about 260 loans over a 12-year history. As their financing has built 16,000 residential units in the UK. They're a very strong category leader in what they do, and the market opportunity in what they're doing is robust. In our perfect world, we would widen where possible some of the good stuff Maslow does across our five countries, and we now have 19 platforms. We'd want to see that style of lending cross-pollinate across the wider Arrow footprint and not just be a single pound-denominated UK product. I think to raise a commingled discretionary fund, it would be off a stronger footing if that were euro-denominated and across five countries. You would meet a much broader direct lending need of a customer base than just being UK-only, denominated in pounds, et cetera. So we're very encouraged by the early progress. You know, we think the market opportunity for that real estate credit, as we said, investors, if you ask them the fundamental question, do you think effectively asset credit at a sensible LTV is a safer investment than corporate credit at an earnings multiple, you get a very positive response from LPs, and yet their book is allocated almost entirely towards corporate credit because it's hard to access asset credit without the local footprint we have.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the early days of cross-pollinating what Maslow does across the totality of the Arrow footprint. Somewhere on that journey, it makes sense to trigger the option, and somewhere on that journey, it makes sense to turn it into a commingled fund. We're not at that point yet.
Got it. That makes sense. And then last on the fund management side, so the bridge lending business that you're building, you know, where are we in terms of, you know, how far away until you start marketing a fund?
So some of that will fit inside what Maslow does. Some of that will fit inside ACO. We're not dependent on raising a fund to deliver volume against that product. We already have enough capital in the existing vehicles to do that. But obviously, our ambition over time would be to scale things like that into their own product, as you've seen us do in other areas.
Okay.
It's a really attractive product, right? I mean, ultimately, the bridging market, I think it is frequently the case that people earn high single digits unlevered, sometimes low double digits unlevered, and rarely, if ever, lose money on a deal as long as you keep LTVs low and you're bridging against liquid hard assets. In our countries, we should have, particularly in Northern Europe, right? So where our distressed products obviously have a bigger incidence in Italy and Portugal than places where there's been a legacy of distress. Things like bridging are much more calibrated towards UK, Netherlands, and Ireland in our Northern European markets. And so it improves our geographic balance, and in the roadshows we've done with LPs on bridging, I think LPs rarely get offered bridging just because you obviously need a deep local franchise. Sometimes you need a lender's regulatory permission, which we have, which is also rare amongst GPs to actually have that position. And so by offering that as a locally sourced, locally managed with regulatory permissions, given the size of our real estate and servicing footprint product, we've seen strong investor interest and little immediate competition in their portfolio allocation today. And I think in today's environment, particularly if banks retreat, that could be a really interesting area. So we have high ambitions for that activity, but we're quite a far way off, I'd say, converting that into a standalone fund. For now, we'll fund that out of partially the capital sources Matt already has committed and partially the ones that Arrow has in ACO2.
Okay, got it. That's clear. And then just switching to the balance sheet business, so one question on that. So the ERC reforecast of £420 million, any how does the cadence of that, how are you expecting the cadence of that? Any lumpy one-offs that kind of will skew the quarterly results?
Obviously, the lumpiness around the divestment is obviously significant in that in the 420 figures. So the divestment to Intrum of the £91 million is clearly the most significant lumpiness in that.
Okay, understood. Thank you. That's it for me.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. We will take the next question from Tom Gibney from BNP Paribas.
Hi, good morning. Sorry to ask about the UK business as it's being disposed, but I just wondered, obviously you've increased the ERC to an extent versus what it was on the lockbox date. Could you say how the performance was of that book in the first quarter compared to what you were expecting as of the lockbox date, and whether that's changed materially versus the fourth quarter?
No, broadly the UK unsecured portfolios have performed in line with our ERC, which is broadly the case in Q4 last year. So we've not seen any deterioration in the performance really, despite the macro challenges.
And so, and given it's performed in line, how does that match with the increase in the increased reforecast?
So the accounting for the divestment is relatively complex. The because we're not booking revenues. That's why you get an uplift. So you should actually look at the net number rather than the gross numbers in that. So there hasn't actually been an uplift in the portfolios. It's just an accounting, just the way the accounts get presented.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you weren't. It's almost like a catch up from the collections that you hadn't been booking.
Yeah, in effect, yes.
Okay, right. So all through the period since the lockbox date, that's been performing in line with the ERC. There's been no change.
Broadly speaking, yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
Again, as a final reminder, to ask a question over the phone, please press *1. As there are no further questions in the queue, I will hand the call back over to Mr. Louis for any closing remarks.
Yeah, appreciate the good discussion, and thank you, moderator and participants. Look forward to chatting with you in August to cover our Q2s. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.